The next case is James Zika versus Elder Care of Minnesota et al. We are ready for argument from appellant's attorney. Please state your name for the record before beginning your argument.
Suzanne Scheller.
You may begin.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Suzanne Scheller, attorney for appellant James Zika. Injured parties are not treated alike under Minnesota law, and this case highlights those disparities under the guardianship and wrongful death statutes. Jean Krause was an extremely vulnerable adult who was sexually assaulted while a resident of an assisted living and died 4 months later of advanced Alzheimer's disease. She, like others in the combined class of advanced age and disability in long-term care facilities, experienced harm due to negligence, yet their remedy is extinguished upon death from unrelated causes.
Well, remedy against the guardian. I mean, you did have a remedy against the nursing home. Would that be a fair statement, Ms. Scheller?
So, Your Honor, our argument under Subdivision 2 under the second issue of constitutionality is that the remedy, even against the nursing home related to the damages, is extinguished by application of Subdivision 2. So we have two issues before the court. Sexual assault victims are not treated alike. That is part of the constitutional argument. If Jean Krause were younger, she would have had time to bring a claim of injury and collect damages for her pain and suffering. But she had no opportunity.
You know, Michelle, I'm sorry, I'm dense on this. Are you telling me that your client, because of this statute, was prohibited from suing the nursing home?
Your Honor, a person can bring a claim. The issue is whether or not there's damages. And under subdivision.
Ms. Scheller, I think this statute, you're focusing on Chapter 573 right now, not the guardianship law.
Correct.
You're beginning with the abatement. The claim dies with the client. So that,
correct.
Okay, so that's why we're having.
Certainly.
If you want to start with that constitutional claim on the abatement statute, you can. I think the guardianship statute might be the way to start, but you could continue with the constitutional one first if you want.
Certainly. Both the arguments under both statutes is that the tortfeasors are not being held accountable and there's a windfall. So there is a connection of that argument. But there are two main issues that we are asking this court to
let me ask, just to clarify, I'm sorry to interrupt you. When we get to the abatement statute, the claim that you would have against the nursing home would, for general damages for negligence, also would have died with Ms. Krause. There was presumably a claim for contract breach or something like that as well, I assume, right?
This is a claim of personal injury. And so there was no special damages in this claim. Jean Krause received no post-sexual assault care. She was already in an assisted living. Therefore, we have no damages, no special damages.
Yes, I understand that. I'm just getting back to the question of the problem that you have with the abatement statute would apply equally to a claim against a nursing home as a claim against.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so that's just, when can I bring a claim? When can a personal representative bring a claim on behalf of a deceased person? And for personal injury, for claims that don't relate to the injury that caused death, they're limited to special damages for all types, right?
That's correct. And Okay. Again, in this case, it is disproportionately applied in the abatement area to Jean Krause and those similarly situated. But first, we need to get through an immunity statute on the guardianship issue. So there's two main issues to review de novo, and we're asking this court to reverse the district court's opinion and remand when finding first that a guardian may be liable for their own acts of negligence, even under 524.5-313 paragraph C2. Any other result would be undermine our entire guardianship system of protection. And number two, Minnesota statute 573.02 is unconstitutional as applied to Jean Krause and those similarly situated who are disproportionately affected by the limit on special damages. Turning to the first issue, the guardian may be liable for their own acts of negligence. The court granted all duties and powers to the guardian under 313C in all paragraphs 1-7. The respondent accepted those duties under oath, and the facts of respondent's negligence are undisputed and egregious, and she admits to those. Respondent was removed as conservator for cause. The appellant was appointed conservator. Respondent knew about Jean Krause's sexual assault from day one, yet did not seek post-sexual assault care or relief and prevented others from doing so.
The issue that we need to focus on, and not to interrupt, but I know our time is short, on the is the determination that the guardian shall have no personal or monetary liability. The failure to satisfy the needs and requirements of this clause shall be grounds for removal, but the guardian shall have no personal or monetary liability.
Yes.
The question is the meaning of that. Okay.
Yes.
And so, and that is within only section C2 of the duties that are listed. And your argument is that should be read to mean it shall have no personal or monetary liability for failing to seek available government benefits.
That's correct, Your
and
Honor.
It doesn't mean anything else. Now, you obviously the first question is why it doesn't say that. We have to do a plain language review. Why under, I guess the first question is, do you think does a plain language tell us that it relates only to government benefits? Explain that to us. Or is this ambiguous such that we need to go to other sources to interpret
it? We need to go to other sources, Your Honor. It is ambiguous under in regardianship of SHUMI. A statute is ambiguous if it is subject to differing interpretations, and then the canons of construction must be applied. The plain meaning is not appropriate in this particular instance, because when we look at particularly the word clause, that is not modifying the entire paragraph C2. For instance, when a court orders appointment of guardian, in their order, they order which paragraphs under C the guardian has a power and a duty in. And so they are referred to as paragraphs. This is an entire paragraph. The duty statute is primarily a duty statute, and the idea of payment came later. So we look
so,
to-
I'm sorry, let me, before you go on from there, what is this? Because I don't remember seeing this in your briefs. So this is sort of new to me, I think. What is this clause? You're arguing that this clause does not mean paragraph 2, is that right?
It means the last sentence of paragraph 2, and that is by legislative intent. The fact
not
that
the last immunity, sentence. The last sentence is the immunity sentence. So
the last.
So what is failure to satisfy the needs and requirements of this clause? What does this clause mean?
The securing of government benefits, and we believe
the previous sentence, the second
correct.
To last sentence.
Correct.
Okay. And
so
why would that be? How do we know that?
We know that by legislative intent. We do have the hearing testimony when this particular statute was being discussed by the legislature. In 1980, the guardianship statute was significantly overhauled, and the duties of the guardian to provide care, maintenance, clothing were listed, and that the guardian did not have to pay for those care items personally. And then it went on to state when a possible secure government benefits for that care. In 1981, the legislature came back to add the last sentence of this paragraph. And in that last sentence, the Legal Services Advocacy Project testified before the legislature to clarify the meaning of that last sentence. And they state that there is a clarification that the failure to secure benefits is grounds for removal, but not liability. So that testimony—
Can I pause for a second? Because I do want to get into that and look at the 1981 legislative history and have some questions about that. But I'm just trying to understand, I thought you were making a plain language kind of argument that failure to satisfy the needs and requirements of this clause, that this clause on its face refers to the sentence preceding it, which is government benefits. And that somehow we know that because the word clause is generally not used for paragraphs.
Your Honor, that is used in an ambiguous argument, actually.
Okay.
What I'm stating, yes. What I'm stating is that this statute is ambiguous, that the district court appears to have interpreted it one way, and another interpretation is fleshed out, if you will, by the legislative intent surrounding that last sentence.
Can I ask about the legislative intent? So that what you helpfully provided in your appendix, or addendum rather, is a summary of changes that was presented by an advocacy group that appears to a Senate hearing in 1981, right? How is it that we know, I mean, part of the, of course, vagaries of figuring out what the legislature means by picking things out. I want you to put that in context for me. For example, how do we know what the House thought? Was this present in other settings within the legislative history, et cetera? Why would we know that this is what we know is meant because of this one hearing?
So there's a couple of reasons. You look at the entire legislative history of this particular statute. This is the main statute by which the duties of the guardian are formed. And so that has been what this statute and its predecessors have been about. Secondly, when we look at those changes in 80 and 81 in particular, there actually was a separate subdivision that was proposed in C7, I believe it was, that talked about the securing of benefits. So this idea of payment for care is a significant one. Medical assistance applications need to be made. If there's a gap, it can cost be very costly. There appears to be, a heightened focus on the payment for the care. This idea that of a power to create or to make application was added in 2003. So we have other indicators that the intent of the payment here was that the guardian should try to secure payment from other sources. But if they failed to do so, they would not be liable for the gap in payment, for instance, from when a medical assistance application was made to when it was approved, for instance.
It's just interesting to me in looking at the 1981 amendments that, so you gave us a summary that was presented to a Senate hearing in April in 1981. And then in March 1981, you also gave us the original or an earlier draft of the bill. Mm-hmm. At addendum 49, that earlier draft had the immunity language at the end of all the duties.
Right.
Suggesting that they were considering whoever introduced it or whatever, having the immunity apply to not just paragraph C2, but C3, C4, C blah, blah, blah. And they moved it to C2.
Correct.
I don't know that that helps or hurts you. You know, it could be that that just meant, oh, well, we want to limit it to the duties of care, support, and maintenance. We don't want to also have it be applying to C3, C4, C5. You know, you wanted to mean an even narrower thing. Oh, it's just the government benefits sentence that's in C2. But you see what I'm saying? Like, how do
yes.
we know that?
Yes, Your Honor. We also look at the conservator statute. That was not suggested in the conservator statute as to applying to all paragraphs. The same language got applied into the conservator statute at that time. That is now this last sentence of the guardianship statute. So we believe, again, the change from the separate paragraph to the identical conservator guardian paragraphs is further indication of the limitation of this thought process. And again, we also need to look to the issue that under 315B, guardian immunity was discussed for the first time related to the 2003 adoption of the Uniform Guardians Protective Proceedings Act. And 315B allows for immunity for the guardian for third party acts, but it was specifically discussed and rejected that there would be any language that states that a guardian would not be personally liable for their own negligence. Again, the conservator statute allows personal liability for their own negligence under 430B. And finally, if we look at...
Before you leave there, I think I just heard you say it was discussed with respect to 315. Did you give us that in 2003?
Correct.
Did you give us that citation to that legislative history?
Yes, I did. In the addendum is the 2003 adoption of the Uniform Guardians and Protective Proceedings Act. And the Minnesota decided not to adopt the duty statute, but rather keep their own duty statute in C2. And then they decided to adopt the immunity statute under 315B.
I know that happened, but did you provide us, I thought you talked about discussions that happened. Did you cite us to hearing transcripts or something?
There is a hearing transcript within the addendum, the appellant's addendum related to the 2003 discussions of that change, that adoption. Your Honor, I need to move forward here. the absurdity of a full blanket immunity to the guardian is also extremely concerning. It would have grave consequences for wards.
Well, I mean, that's for Ms. Scheller. Do you agree that there's a difference between professional guardians and private guardians? And by that, I assume that the difference is presumably the professional ones are paid and the private ones are not paid.
So this should apply for all. Again, I want to reiterate because a person,
if it's applied to all, here's my biggest concern, you know, and we can all, I mean, and I understand your argument as to the clause and stuff, but the bigger argument I have is, you know, it's not like you've got all these people lining up to volunteer their time to be private guardians. out there. Now, it's different, you know, for Lutheran Brotherhood, who's getting paid, then I'm sure they'd be thrilled to do it. But if this is just neighbors, and in this case, the neighbors, because family members were not prepared to do it, aren't you going to provide a disincentive for, you know, I'll just say private volunteer guardians, if now, particularly in this case where, okay, maybe she should have, well, I'm going to say she should have told them what was going on, but it's not like she was running the nursing home. And I guess the problem I have is that is your construction provides an absolute disincentive for voluntary guardians to do the things we all want them to do.
Your Honor, we disagree. We believe that when we add clarity to the law—
I know you disagree, but my question is, isn't your position going to result in a complete, I mean, you know, you can't even get directors now to serve on nonprofit boards unless there's D&O insurance. Now we're going to extend that to just, you know, the kindly neighborly lady who is just doing this because she's doing this out of the goodness of her heart. And now she's going to be on the hook for not just things, you know, for a situation like this, which I think is not quite what the legislature intended. So why am I wrong?
Because there is a duty and an oath to protect vulnerable adults. And when that occurs, she accepted those duties, private or professional. That is the bedrock of our guardianship system, to protect vulnerable adults. And therefore, there is a limit to what we can do. The guardian would be granted greater immunity than government officials and other parties if this were to stand. And so we
do have— Government officials get paid, and they should be held accountable for their screw-ups. But here, I'm concerned that, you know, we're going beyond that and putting them on the hook. I mean, would you do this? I mean, this isn't even a question of, like, she was put in the wrong nursing home or she didn't check on her. Fair enough. She should have told somebody what happened to this poor woman. But as a result of that, she's now liable for personal and monetary liability with sky's the limit. I think that's not quite how I would read the statute. And I'm not sure that's how the legislature would read the statute.
But I do not believe, Your Honor, in all due respect, that they would read it that the guardian is immune from all liability. They could provide no care, no food, no shelter, even abuse the ward and be subject to no liability for their own negligence. Your Honors, I see I'm at time.
You'll have 5 minutes on rebuttal. We'll hear from Mr. John Vallon now on behalf of respondents. Thank you, Sue. All right, we are back on the record in the case of James Zika versus Elder Care of Minnesota. We're now ready for arguments from counsel for respondent Nari Weaver, and attorney's name for the record is John Vallon. And sir, you may begin your argument.
Thank you. May it please the court, Ms. Scheller. I'll be fairly brief here. I think it's been alluded to already that my client is not a professional guardian. She's an elderly woman, roughly the same age as Ms. Krause. They were neighbors, they were very good friends, and Ms. Weaver did this as a good deed, which of course never goes unpunished. With regard to the immunity, it's our position that there is no ambiguity in that statute. The last sentence refers to needs and requirements. Requirements relates back to the governmental benefits sentence. Needs relates back to the very first sentence of that, care, comfort, and maintenance needs. We believe that it clearly covers that. If the legislature had intended—
Mr. Vallon, can I ask? I mean, it's kind of an odd way to put it, no monetary liability. I mean, that's just unusual. I guess in an immunity statute, it doesn't necessarily always look like that. It also says personal or personal liability. But I think the issue, I mean, what I see is it's kind of a funny place to add an immunity provision at the end of C2. as opposed to in an immunity section. So when the legislature did that in 1981, what did it mean by that? And I think when it added the general immunity part in 2003 from the Uniform Act, it's hard for me to see the immunity that's in there about, well, you won't be responsible, a guardian shall not be responsible for injury in medical care by a third party as long as they reasonably chose the place. It seems like that would already be covered by the broad immunity that would be there from 1981. I'm not really sure why 315 immunity was even necessary, because it seems like the guardian would already have complete immunity under the interpretation of C subdivision. Well, I guess I'm confusing my numbering system. Oh, because I'm in the wrong statute, under C3. I mean, if you have immunity for everything related to decisions around the care, why did we even need 315 to deal with medical care? It seems subsumed by this broad immunity under C3. I think that's maybe you don't follow my question, but it just seems.
Well, I think I follow your question, but okay. I don't have the answer to it.
Okay. Fair.
I mean, in general, I'd say the answer is that the guardian, once appointed, is an officer of the court under the jurisdiction of the probate court. The remedies in all of these statutes that outline the duties is the removal of the guardian. There is no cause of action created under any of those statutes. Frankly, I'm not sure why the immunity thing is needed at all. I don't think.
Right. Well, the district court, I don't think cause of action. Right. I mean, I think the question about whether there is what cause of action here, I think the district court didn't get to that argument of yours that there's no implied cause of action. But dealing with the immunity, I mean, I appreciate that the guardian is a private guardian. This C3 doesn't seem to me to distinguish between a paid guardian or a professional guardian or a not professional guardian. And it seems to be a very broad scope of immunity, you know, unlike lots of immunities where you might have to act reasonably, or there could be, you're not immune if you act with malice. It seems like no matter what you're doing, even acting with malice, the guardian could neglect the person entirely and there'd be no cause of action against them. Is that the way you read it?
Well, there would be a remedy, and that's to remove the guardian. I guess that would be my position. So, I mean, to sum it up, I don't think there's any ambiguity to that statute. If there is, I still don't see how we would read it as Ms. Scheller would have us. I think it's the Legal Services Advocacy Project proposed language that would narrow this down to immunity for failing to seek governmental benefits. The legislature rejected that language and included this broad language. So with regard to the other issue, I think that's a legislative matter. There's no precedent for grouping these two non-suspect classes into one suspect class. I think this general damage issue is for the legislature, and that's where the plaintiff ought to go. Thank you, that's really all I have.
Are there any additional questions for Mr. Valen? Okay, we will then have rebuttal argument from Ms. Scheller. You may proceed.
I will need to focus my time on the second issue for the court. Minnesota Statutes 573 Subdivision 2 was adopted in 1967. It's unique, it's narrow in scope. It applies only to injured persons later dying of unrelated causes. It's most applicable to elderly and disabled vulnerable adults, given they're more likely to die of other comorbidities than those outside their class. No aims of tort law are accomplished upon the application of Subdivision 2 to the purported class. There's no relief to injured parties. There's no liability on responsible parties, and there's no deterrence to commit harmful acts. We believe this violates the Remedies Clause and the Equal Protection Clause. There is a fundamental right to a remedy under Article 1, Section 8, and a fundamental right in Article 1, the Bill of Rights, or a right in the Bill of Rights may be determined to be fundamental, as Skeen v. State said. And Calder v. City of Crystal, stated that a statute in dicta, which does not allow any time whatever to bring a claim, is unconstitutional. And this court in Brink v. Smith Company's construction utilized that to determine the statute was unconstitutional in that particular case. We also believe that this violates the Equal Protection Clause, which purpose is to secure to every person the right to be free from arbitrary and intentional discrimination. The distinction separating a class must not be arbitrary. And in this case, injured parties are not treated alike. The limitation to special damages leads to two harsh results. Jean Krause's class has no time to bring the injury claim while living and thus cannot collect general damages. And two, Jean Krause's class incurs little to no special damages, operating as a complete bar to a remedy. No time plus no special damages equals no remedy and no liability. Injured parties are not the only ones treated dissimilarly. Tortfeasors are not treated alike either. Those injuring the purported class have a windfall under the limitations of subdivision 2. Liability is not placed on the responsible party. No deterrent is occurring in this system of long-term care, and the law is giving license to abuse and neglect. In Thompson v. Estate of Petroff, a portion of the wrongful death statute was determined to be unconstitutional by the Minnesota Supreme Court, offering no justification for treating a negligent tortfeasor different than an intentional tortfeasor. Similarly here, there's no justification for treating a purported class differently than those outside the class. The elderly and disabled are disproportionately affected. And in State v. Russell, the Supreme Court of Minnesota found a criminal statute unconstitutional by application of the statute to a certain defendant, class of defendants. And they stated there must be a reasonable connection between the actual and not just the theoretical effect of the challenged classification. Similarly here, elderly and disabled residents are disproportionately affected. There's no connection between allowing an injury claim yet providing no damages. Residents are being singled out by application. The level of scrutiny is important. Under any level of scrutiny, subdivision 2 serves no compelling, substantial, or legitimate government purpose by extinguishing claims. There is sometimes a threshold issue of a similarly situated test as applied by this court in NH versus Anoka Hennepin School District. We assert that there Jean Krause is an injured party as other injured parties. Sexual assault victims experience rape, violation, trauma, whether age 77 or 27. But the similarities stop there, and under equal protection arguments, they are then distinguished related to their remedies. The 77-year-old in the report.
As you're running low on time, I did want to circle back one to the immunity question briefly. The argument I think you've made, and I understand it, and you describe it in your brief as it's sort of, I think maybe like it's an outrageous turn of events if this is interpreted to give such broad immunity, limitless immunity to guardians for the core duties really of taking care of the care, comfort, maintenance of a person who's subject to guardianship. And that it would, I think implicitly like wreak an enormous change. What's interesting and we didn't find, I didn't see cited in your brief, sort of a history of claims for negligence against guardians that have made it at least to appellate case law. So that's where I was trying to position this, you know, and I wonder if you can speak to us about that.
Yes, Your Honor. I had extensive history on this statute. That is important to the question. It is, again, a duty statute, but we have to remember that guardians and conservators were combined. That concept was combined for decades under Minnesota law. And so we have case law that primarily talks about conservators and maybe a guardian and conservator. This is unique, and there is not a lot of case law on a guardian acting as a guardian alone. And so we have this idea that the statute, when we adopted the Uniform Proceedings Act in 2003, there was an idea that that duty statute should remain because we had case law that kind of went under that statute being the main statute. And there is not any interpretation that I have seen in law, nor in other attorneys who practice in this area, nor in the attorneys who were present in 2003, that this statute would be an immunity statute. It has been communicated as what I have told this court as a failure to secure benefits is grounds for removal, but not liability. So we have, unfortunately, the need to clarify that the guardian is not completely immune from all acts of negligence when we've known that the conservator is not completely immune for years. And so we have this history that—
May I ask one more question? Outside the cases in your brief, and I know the cases in your brief, so you don't need to talk about them. Are there conservatorship cases under the pre-2003 scheme that are for negligence, for personal liability of the conservator for negligence related to conservatorship of the person? That's not cited in your brief.
Well, in the brief, I have Ashton v. Thompson, which is a longstanding case related to conservator. We also have other examples similarly that I do believe were cited in my brief. So I know you're asking for those outside the brief, but that herein presents a difficulty. But in re guardianship de young, we must interpret this statute in light of the entire guardianship statute. We have to look at it as a whole.
Thank you.
And Your Honors, I just want to go back to the other issue. We do believe strict scrutiny should apply with a fundamental right. We believe heightened basis review should apply here, given our standard of protection of this class. We are in a minority of states that abates pain and suffering, and we have coming towards us 118% rise in those age 85 plus between 2019 and 2040. This issue will only be magnified. And so we believe under the heightened rational basis review, even if the court chooses to apply that in the Guillaume's factors that were used in State v. Russell, that this is an arbitrary distinction, that there is no evidence the legislature intended to treat Jean Krause differently than other injured parties, but she is being treated differently by application of the statute. And we just do not believe the purpose of this statute can be met. All three factors of Guillaume's can't be met. And we wanted, and I just asked the court to look at that need for protection, the tort law aims that are not being accomplished, and declares 573.02 subdivision 2 unconstitutional.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate the arguments in the briefing, and thank you for your patience as we work through the technological issues. The matter is submitted. You'll have our decision within the time required by statute. That concludes the hearing.